Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Kevin Moore Show. I'm Kevin Moore, and it is a pleasure to be spending the next hour with you. Our opening musical selection was Promises, Promises, a wonderful song from the great composer Burt Bacharach. And that's what I have for all of you today, the promise that this next hour will be informative, interesting, provocative, and maybe even a little exciting. A promise that our discussions will give you something to think about today and hopefully something to talk about tomorrow. Or what I'd like to think of as a civilized hour of culture and conversation. Well, as I like to do to begin each of our shows, I like to read or share a recent poignant story or an especially interesting essay or some philosophical quotes or thoughts or sometimes even a little poetry that touches or speaks to us all. Well, we were all kind of surprised with the weather that we received here this week. The snow, the rain, the hail, the grasshoppers. We haven't gotten those yet, but I'm sure we're going to. Mary Schmick wrote a little column about the late snow. I thought I'd share with everyone. Very talented writer from the Chicago Tribune. She writes, "Late snow, it's so, get over it, Chicago." Mary writes, "The snow fell like bullets. The people cried, wait. It cannot be snowing. Why? Look at the date. We're almost in March. This is no time for sleet. It's too late for plowing the slush from the street. Too late for the scrapers and shovels and salt. This late-breaking snow, it must come to a halt." The snow was as shocking as host Seth MacFarlane. A sexist, a racist, or was he a darling? And speaking of Oscar, that silly boob song, not grandly offensive and yet somehow wrong. Imagine a show that's devoted to arts, devoting a number to men's private parts. But yes, I digress from the weather, and so we will now return to the late-breaking snow. It snowed and kept snowing an inch by the hour. A wintry mix, that's a messy snow shower. It blew side to side, and it blew up and down. It coated the trees, and it smothered the town. Some people were happy, all snuggled indoors, all cozy with books while they toasted s'mores. But out in the mix, it was not quite so pretty. No, out in the mess, it was sloppy and gritty. The cars slipped and slid, and the airplanes got stuck. The sidewalks were deadly. The people said, expletive. Those people were cranky. They could not be calm. Or what could they do? Could they blame it on Rahm? Or blame it on Congress for wrecking our nation with late-breaking snow and that darn sequestration? It's heart attack snow, all the weather folk said. The people, they shivered and quivered with dread. Spring, the folk whimpered. It's so very near. We thought from here out we'd be in the clear. Oh, people, get real. It's spring in L.A., but spring in Chicago? Heck, that's not until May. We know in Chicago that winter hangs on like flu that recurs when you think that it's gone. Perhaps we're made weak by the balmy December, those sweet, snowless days. Global warming, remember? That debt has come due here in winter's last lap. We'll finish the season by shoveling expletive. But look on the bright side. There's hope in the pain, for each foot of snow is like an inch of new rain. The stuff that we're shoveling with curses and pouts in summer will help keep the farmers from droughts. So, here's to the late-breaking snowblower's roar, and bet that we're in for at least a little bit more. I think we are. But it's interesting, they were saying, just as an aside, they were saying that usually it's 1 inch of water means 8 inches of snow. But this was such heavy snow, it's 1 inch of water was 10 inches of snow. We didn't get that much, but we got quite a bit. I like it, though. I do. It's sloppy, and you know it's going to get warmer and slushy, but we never did get it in December. It's nice to have it now. It really is. A little different. Everything's so a winter wonderland. I think, what is it, the first day of spring is Friday? Oh, we'll see. Want to make sure I mention our friends at Provision Theater and their latest hit play, Fish Eyes. A routine morning in a small fishing town. Two brothers, fishermen who had a poor catch last night. They have no idea that they're about to encounter a man who will change their lives forever. This stranger is different, simple, wise, vulnerable, but strong. And he turns their world upside down. Full of surprises, questions, confusion, pain, joy, and miracles. The story of Jesus and the disciples has fascinated us for 2,000 years. Fish Eyes is a poignant and humorous look at how this God-man affected the world through two very human sets of eyes, Peter and Andrew. Of course, another great hit for Tim Gregory and the group at Provision Theater, located at 1001 West Roosevelt Road, kitty corner from St. Ignatius on Roosevelt Road and across the street from UIC. For information, 312-455-0066. Great little place to stop at over the weekend and see some terrific theater, Provision Theater. Well, we should talk about them, the Oscars. We talked about them last week. We should talk about the winners, the losers, happy and sad. Classless Oscar telecast, in my opinion. You look at all the great Oscars. In fact, Kitty Couric had a special on last week about the Oscars, and we look back at all the great hosts of the Oscars. People like Bob Hope for so many years hosted the Oscars, and then, of course, Billy Crystal did it. Johnny Carson did it. Billy Crystal probably be the most popular in the modern era. And we've had some pathetic Oscar hosts like James Franco and Anne Hathaway a few years ago. And Seth MacFarlane, very, very talented man, very funny guy, and seemed very comfortable. But the Oscar telecast in general, I thought, was classless. You know, as I said in the poem written by Mary Schmeek, the parody on the boobs, you know, really, I mean, would we do the same for men's private parts, as she said? Kind of tasteless. No really blockbuster numbers, blockbuster enjoyable skits that they had there. Of course, it was nice to see Shirley Bassey, of course, who made so many great hits from the James Bond movies, in particular the great Goldfinger, Barbara Streisand in a tribute to Marvin Hamlisch, The Way We Were. But other than that, nothing really stuck out. We really don't care about Kristen Chenoweth and Seth MacFarlane kind of ridiculing the losers. I didn't get the purpose of that, just to fill time at the end of the show. And some of the remarks I thought were off-color, unnecessary. So it kind of pales in comparison to some of the great Oscar telecasts of past, and sort of casts a pallor, I think, on what we'd look at as a certain amount of class in Hollywood. But nonetheless, just my opinion. The winners, and I think very deservedly so, Argo, beating out some great nominated movies like Beasts of the Southern Wild, Les Miserables, Life of Pi, and Zero Dark Thirty, but certainly well-deserved. It's on video now, so if you haven't seen it, geez, see it, because you're going to be on the edge of your seat. It's just a terrific, terrific movie. Best Actor, Daniel Day-Lewis in Lincoln. No question about it. I think he was the front runner, won every other award, and certainly deservedly so again. Jennifer Lawrence for Silver Linings Playbook for the Best Actress. Jessica Chastain did a terrific job. Emmanuel Riva in Amour did a terrific job. Naomi Watts did a wonderful job. Went to Jennifer Lawrence. I'm not sure. I'm sure down the line she'll be nominated, as with a young girl, Wallace. An opinion, I think, that some people had. Best Director, which was even more interesting because the best picture was Argo, yet Ben Affleck was not nominated for Best Director. That went to Ang Lee for Life of Pi. If you haven't seen that, unfortunately, you should see it, I think, on the big screen. It's going to lose some cachet when you see it on your home video, unless you have a 100-inch screen. But it was a terrific movie, something like you've never seen before. Some of the quality of the movie itself was just remarkable. And Ang Lee won for Best Director. I think he won for Brokeback Mountain a few years ago. Supporting actor, Christopher Walken. It surprised a lot of people. I think Tom Lee Jones was up, and as was Robert De Niro. But Christopher Walken won it for Django Unchained. Supporting actress again, not unexpected, Anne Hathaway in Les Miserables. Animated feature film was Brave, and that was a funny. It was a funny animated feature. I kind of thought Wreck-It Ralph would win, but the best song, sung by Adele, which is another high point of the Oscars, was from Skyfall, and it was. It was a terrific song. I didn't realize she wrote it also. Music and lyrics by Adele and Paul Epworth. Skyfall won it from James Bond, and great movie. That also is on video. So there you have it. Some surprises, some not, but evening was less than expected, less than expected. Again, just my opinion. Lost a couple good friends this past week. Carol Condren's dad, Mr. Fischella, passed away, and Pete Trapani's dad, Peter Trapani. Said goodbye to him. I came across an interesting little poem by Marie Howe about dead friends and so forth, and I thought I'd share it. Entitled, My Dead Friends by Marie Howe. I have begun, when I'm weary and can't decide an answer to a bewildering question, to ask my dead friends for their opinion. And the answer is often immediate and clear. Should I take the job? Move to the city? Should I try to conceive a child in my middle age? They stand in unison, shaking their heads and smiling. Whatever leads to joy, they always answer. To more life and less worry. I look into the vase where Billy's ashes were. It's green in there, a green vase. And I ask Billy if I should return the difficult phone call. And he says, yes. Billy's already gone through the frightening door. Whatever he says, I'll do. Interesting short little poem by Marie Howe. Interesting answer, too, when it's posed to those who are no longer with us. They stand in unison, shaking their heads and smiling. Whatever leads to joy, they always answer, to more life and less worry. Interesting little poem. My Dead Friends by Marie Howe. William Shakespeare was the most remarkable storyteller that the world has ever known. Homer told of adventure and men at war. Sophocles and Tolstoy told of tragedies and of people in trouble. Terence and Mark Twain told comic stories. Dickens told melodramatic ones. Plutarch told histories. And Hans Christian Andersen told fairy tales. But Shakespeare told every kind of story. Comedy, tragedy, history, melodrama, adventure, love stories, and fairy tales. And each of them so well that they have become immortal. In all the world of storytelling, his is the greatest name. The Shakespeare Project of Chicago will present its original adaptation of Shakespeare's sonnets and songs, My Name is Will, at the Park Ridge Public Library on Thursday, March 7th at 7 o'clock. Shakespeare's sonnets represent some of his most personal and emotionally charged writing. Shakespeare Project Artistic Director Peter Guarino has created a dramatic context for 35 of the sonnets, augmented by 11 songs from 8 of Shakespeare's plays. The distinctly American music of Chris Walls, who toured with the world with the Special Consensus Bluegrass Band and currently teaches at the Old Town School of Folk Music, provides a dramatic counterpoint to the bard's poetry and lyrics. Join us for this musical celebration that features beautiful poetry, original music, and 4 of your favorite Shakespeare Project actors. Running time is approximately 53 minutes. A discussion will follow the performance. Reservations are required by calling the Park Ridge Public Library at 847-825-3123. And on the line with us right now is the award-winning star of stage, screen, and television, having been seen on the stages of the Steppenwolf Theater, Organic Theater, Oak Park Festival Theater, and Pegasus Players, studied at the National Shakespeare Conservatory, holds an MFA from Illinois State University, writer, playwright, teacher, mentor, one of the brightest stars in the world of contemporary Shakespearean theater, and the artistic director and a founding member of the Shakespeare Project of Chicago, now presenting My Name is Will, the music and the work of William Shakespeare, Thursday, March 7th at 7 at the Park Ridge Public Library, 20 South Prospect in Park Ridge. And on the line with us right now, Mr. Peter Guarino. Peter, welcome back to the Kevin Moore Show.
Thank you, Kevin. Great to be speaking with you again.
Always a pleasure, and a little different approach to Shakespeare. We're going to enjoy some of his music.
That's right. The piece that we've put together contains songs, as you said, from 11 songs from 8 of his plays, and 35 sonnets that present various aspects of love, and the music really helps to underscore and bring home some of the conflicts that are present in the sonnets. And it's been a very successful piece for us over these many years. We've done it many times, and we're looking forward to doing it in Park Ridge.
Well, music was always an integral part of Elizabethan life, all different types of music, broadside ballads and consort pieces and madrigals and serenades and catches and jigs. And Shakespeare used his songs to evoke mood and kind of establish a character's mental state of the singer that was involved in his plays and in his sonnets. And this is what you're kind of doing, is kind of taking it. We're used to listening to the work of Shakespeare. Now we see what it's like to feel Elizabethan life a little bit.
That's right. The difference with our show and the music that Chris has produced for us is that the music is definitely not Baroque sounding music. It's music that's written by an American artist. Chris, the music that he uses is everything from folk, pop, blues, jazz. And it really is a very interesting interpretation of these songs that appear in Shakespeare's plays. When people hear the songs in the context of My Name is Will, it definitely sounds like the words are all Shakespeare, but the music evokes a different quality altogether.
Well, I think The Tempest and Twelfth Night have the most music in the Shakespearean plays. You've chosen 11 songs that are featured in My Name is Will. What plays are they from?
We have songs from The Merchant of Venice, Merry Wives of Windsor, as you said, Twelfth Night, which we just did this past weekend at our four libraries. The other plays are As You Like It, Troilus and Cressida, Othello, Measure for Measure, and Cymbeline.
Mm-hmm. Now, what was your motivation putting this together, this piece together? Kind of different. I have not seen this before. I don't think it's been done in Chicago before.
Well, you rarely see the sonnets performed on the stage. The sonnets, many critics have always believed that the sonnets represent Shakespeare's what's described as non-dramatic poetry. In other words, poetry that doesn't appear in his 37 plays. Mm-hmm. You'll usually find the sonnets tucked away at the end of a complete works of Shakespeare. I always love the sonnets. I love that they're so personal. They're all written in the first person. And there's so much conflict that's inherent in a sonnet. If you read a sonnet, you have three elements to it. You have the person who's speaking the sonnet, mm-hmm. or thinking these thoughts. You have the person who he's directing his thoughts to, mm-hmm. which in many cases is the lover or the other person in the relationship. And then there's always a third person or a third thing, and that could be, again, someone else, or it could be, you know, some force that's acting upon them. But when you have that triangle of relationships in a single piece, you inherently have conflict. And what we do in My Name is Will is we put the speaker of the sonnet on the stage, and we also put the person who is receiving the sonnet, the listener. And anytime you put two people on the stage together like that, it becomes dramatic in and of itself. And in many cases, we'll also have the third person that might be, again, the other person that's involved in the relationship lurking in the background or somewhere there as well. So it really does become a very dramatic and impactful experience for the people who are attending.
More so than you would expect one person just reading a sonnet. You have it's like a madrigal, basically, because it's more than two or three people that are involved in it.
That's right. It's the difference between, let's say, just reading a poem, right, which is someone, let's say, just getting up and reading a poem, and a sonnet is always, in my mind, very, you know, analogous to like a monologue or a soliloquy from mm-hmm. Shakespeare's plays. So when you actually put that person up there in the present, so to speak, and in a relationship with someone else, that becomes very, very dramatic just by doing that. And people really respond to the story of the sonnet in a different way because of that dynamic.
Shakespeare wrote 154 sonnets, and you are using 35 of them. If you had to pick, or can you pick, Peter, a major theme throughout Shakespeare's sonnets, would they be love? Would it be conflict? Would it be relationships?
Well, that's a great question, and that really kind of gets me to how did I end up putting these 35 sonnets into this piece as opposed to the others? When you look at the sonnets and you read them, they're a kind of a landscape, if you will, of different emotions. I was very, very interested in what you might call the jagged, undulating terrain where Shakespeare explores things like betrayal, jealousy, inadequacy, separation, both physical separation and emotional separation. Then as you go across this landscape, there might be what you might call a higher ground, right, that celebrates the joy and the more blissful moments in relationships, such as things like love and redemption, reconciliation, recommitment. That's what you see in this piece. It's a journey. Four actors, these two couples, kind of go through this journey together, and you see, the very many, many different aspects of love. I think sometimes people think the most famous sonnet, right, of Shakespeare's is perhaps "Shall I Compare Thee to a Summer's Day?" I think it's sonnet 18. And it's a very kind of bucolic and lovely ode to beauty and love. But most people don't really read or may not be familiar with some of these other elements that he gets into in the sonnets. And again, in our piece, the music that we have chosen to use, again, serves to enhance and augment the ideas of the themes that we're presenting.
Getting into the music, when you listen to or had the music of Elizabethan England, various instruments would evoke different moods. When they played an oboe during a Shakespearean play years ago, it kind of presaged doom or disaster, the ill winds that come if some problem came up. If you had a lute or viola in the comedies, it meant that it was something good was about to happen. And the tragedies and histories, even now, when we see Shakespeare put on, there's an echo of trumpet and drums because we figure something serious is happening. How is Chris approaching that with, I would think, his bluegrass band and a banjo and guitar and so forth?
That's a great question. When Chris first recorded the score for My Name is Will back in 2000, he did it on guitar.
Mm-hmm.
And the guitar string instrument would be very analogous to the lute, right, that was used during Shakespeare's time. 6 years after after he originally recorded the music in 2006, he went back and I asked him to write music to a few additional songs that I wanted to include in the piece. And at that time, he was very much into keyboard and piano, and he asked me if it would be okay for him to essentially re-record the entire score for the performance on keyboard. And it's interesting because there is such a difference between a guitar and a keyboard. In many ways, the sounds of both instruments evoke different kinds of qualities. So the current score that we're using is the piano score, but at the same time, the style of music that he's written for the various songs, runs the gamut from, like I said, folk to pop. And then into blues and jazz, which also, it does not sound like Shakespeare, but it's so right for these songs and for the piece that we're doing.
I'm reminded of it looks like a guitar. It's a round guitar. I think it's called a cittern that they use in Elizabethan England. So you still have the guitar kind of feel back then, but now, of course, you've introduced the keyboards to the whole process, which gives it a whole different feel.
It does, and I think it's part of what we're doing with this piece is not necessarily to try to bring people back to Elizabethan England. What we're doing is we're taking these poems, these lovely love poems that were written over 400 years ago, And we're really bringing them into the here and now, and that's what this piece does. It really asserts itself in the present and makes people think about their own relationships and their own feelings about the, you know, many dimensions of love and relationships. And that the music and the score, in a way, is very contemporary in that regard. So it really does overall support and assert this piece, not as like a historical piece, but something that is happening now and that people can experience now. And of course, the great thing is that the words are all those of Shakespeare and were written, you know, that many years ago.
Well, you know, I'm always been bordering on being X-40, and we talked about this before, but you're turning me into a Strat-40. but of course, you know, a lot of people say that Shakespeare's sonnets are non-dramatic poetry. Well, there's a lot of drama. There's a lot of feeling to his poetry, to his sonnets.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And it's very easy to see when you spend any time with the sonnets, to see the emotional connection that he has to the material, and it, you know, being very analogous to the kinds of great emotions that you see in his characters and his plays.
I want to ask a very personal question of you, Peter.
Okay.
Do you read anything else besides Shakespeare?
Oh, absolutely.
You're so immersed in Shakespeare, you're probably one of the most knowledgeable guys I've ever spoken with about Shakespeare. I enjoy it immensely. I hope you do, too, in our conversations. But I just enjoy chatting with you about this because it's such an interesting he's such an interesting person in a lot of different ways.
Absolutely. I love Shakespeare, and I've spent a lot of my time directing and helping bring his work to students in schools now through the work that we do with the Shakespeare Project, and it's great. I mean, you're working with the greatest dramatist and writer in the history of the English language, so it's a privilege.
Well, I thank you and your ensemble for carrying on that legacy. The Shakespeare Project of Chicago was created to achieve three main goals: to bring to life the words of William Shakespeare and the world's other great dramatists, to foster the talents of members of Actors' Equity Association, the professional union of actors and stage managers, to present the plays to members of our community for free. Our mission today includes educational outreach programs to augment Shakespeare studies for middle school, high school, and university students, with our approach driven by a simple goal: make the students' first experience with Shakespeare a positive one. Over the past 16 years, the Shakespeare Project of Chicago has produced theatrical readings of over 80 classic plays, each of Shakespeare's plays at least once, presented by professional actors to audiences free of charge. Utilizing the talents of Equity actors with credits ranging from Broadway, off-Broadway, regional houses, preeminent Shakespeare festivals, and the major Illinois houses, we make these passionately performed classics available to all without regard to income, race, age, or any other demographic. Our artistic focus is firmly rooted in the text of the play, illuminating meaning and emotion through the actor's exploration of the world in words. The Shakespeare Project of Chicago will present its original adaptation of Shakespeare's sonnets and songs, My Name is Will, at the Park Ridge Public Library on Thursday, March 7th at 7 o'clock. Shakespeare's sonnets represent some of his most personal and emotionally charged writing. Shakespeare Project Artistic Director Peter Guarino has created a dramatic context for 35 of the sonnets, augmented by 11 songs from 8 of Shakespeare's plays. And on the line with us right now is Peter Guarino. Peter, maybe a phone number, website, if people like to get some information?
Sure. More information, Kevin, is on our website at www.shakespeareprojectchicago.org. And people can make reservations at the Park Ridge Public Library by calling 847-825-3100.
Well, always a pleasure, my pal. And do you know if there's anything we can do to get the word out about the Shakespeare Project of Chicago or William Shakespeare himself? We're happy to do that.
Kevin, it's always great talking to you, and really appreciate you helping us get our word out.
Take care, my pal.
Okay. I'll see you.
Peter Guarino, the artistic director of the Shakespeare Project of Chicago. It should be very interesting at the Park Ridge Public Library on the 7th, March 7th at 7 o'clock, 20 South Prospect in Park Ridge. And again, for information, 773-710-2718. I always feel intellectually stimulated when I talk with Peter. It's always great to talk about Shakespeare and get some ideas out and, you know, just enjoy the greatest writer of all time. And I always look forward to chatting with my next very special guest. Award-winning choreographers Anne Reinking and Melissa Thodos are teaming again to choreograph A Light in the Dark, the story of Helen Keller and Anne Sullivan, their second full-length story ballet, this time based on the story of Helen Keller, the extraordinary woman who was deaf and blind yet went on to become a world-famous writer, political activist, and inspiration to all who know her incredible story. A Light in the Dark, the story of Helen Keller and Ann Sullivan, follows Photos Dance Chicago's recent success with The White City, Chicago's Columbian Exposition of 1893, a ranking Photos collaboration that told the story of Chicago's legendary 1893 World's Fair through contemporary dance and was named Best Dance 2011 by the Chicago Sun-Times. A Light in the Dark, the story of Helen Keller and Ann Sullivan, will be the first act of Photos Dance Chicago's Winter Concert 2013, which also will boast a second act featuring the new work Rest Is Not Always Possible by West Coast choreographer K.T. Nelson, co-artistic director of ODC Dance Company in San Francisco. Another new work by TDC founder and artistic director Melissa Thodos titled Subtle Passages, plus a company premiere from TDC's recent New Dances 2012 choreography performance series. Thodos Dance Chicago's Winter Concert 2013 will be presented on Saturday, March 2nd at 8 o'clock and Sunday, March 3rd at 2 at the Harris Theater for Music and Dance, 205 East Randolph in downtown Chicago. For tickets, call 312-334-7777. On the line with us right now is the nationally recognized and award-winning choreographer having performed worldwide, one of Chicago's 100 women making a difference. A choreographer with, as critics have noted, a bright and lively imagination, emphasizing the creation of a well-defined mood, interesting group patterns, and attention to design in her work. Teacher, mentor, one of the brightest stars in the world of dance, and the founder and artistic director of Thodos Dance Chicago, now presenting A Light in the Dark, a story ballet about Helen Keller and Ann Sullivan at the Harris Theater for Music and Dance, Saturday, March 2nd. And Sunday, March 3rd, our good friend, Melissa Thodos. Melissa, welcome back to the Kevin Moore Show.
Oh, thanks so much. It's thrilling to be back. Thanks for inviting me.
Always a pleasure, kiddo. And congratulations on another great success following The White City with this wonderful, wonderful story ballet.
Well, thank you so much. You know, Ann and I, when we get together, we just love to tell stories. And there's so many wonderful stories in our American history that deserve to be told and that need to be told. And it was, like The White City, a very rewarding process for a very different piece of equal import to us, and we feel to our environment and our world.
You guys are the dynamic duo. You come up with hits all the time. I mean, it becomes it's a tough one act to follow, one before the other.
Oh, well, we feel very grateful and very lucky to all of our supporters who come out and come see our work. And again, we're very, very impassioned with these stories, and they really fuel our creativity and our inspiration. And our goal with our work is to inspire others and to think about, you know, with this particular work, the inspiration of the story of Helen Keller and Ann Sullivan.
Well, you know, we've all been introduced to this, Melissa, many years ago by the miracle work with Anne Bancroft and Patty Duke. And, you know, as we get older and find out what a remarkable woman this Helen Keller was, deaf and blind at 19 months, and Annie Sullivan, who came and stayed with her whole life, and she became a famous writer, a political activist, a lecturer. I think she started the American Civil Liberties Union, did she not?
Well, absolutely. She was the Disabilities Act seed was most certainly planted with her work, and also in regard to our work, we really equally feature the life and the work of Ann Sullivan with Helen Keller, because together as a team, they did some amazing things in their lives together to really change the world.
And I think, interesting, in your research, you've traveled to the Helen Keller National Center on Long Island, and you interacted with the people there.
Oh, yes. Part of our initial research, once we decided that this was the next story that we wanted to tell, and we decided this at the closing night dinner of The White City, and all of the collaborators were sitting around the table, and everyone said, okay, that one's done, and and it premiered in Chicago, and now we'll be touring it extensively next year. The White City is now has a touring, many touring engagements around the country, which we're excited about. But everyone was going, okay, what's next? And everyone started throwing out ideas. And then our colleague, Gary Christ, who has been a wonderful assistant and theatrical coach for our productions, really was captivated by one of our featured senior dancers, Jessica Miller Tomlinson's role and performance of one of Holmes's victims in The White City. And there's a specific scene where she's actually in a death box and she suffocates, and it's heart-wrenching. And it was something that we needed to point out because there was the White City was the best of the best and the worst of the worst. But that particular moment for Gary, he started getting ideas about her. She's this young little redhead dancer with so much vim and vigor. And he things started coming to him, and then finally he just blurted out, you know, having seen Jessica do this, I think we should try to do the story of Helen Keller. And everything at the table got quiet because it just felt right. And that's when we knew. So following that, about 6 months later, Ann and I met in New York, and we traveled to the Helen Keller National Center on Long Island. And we spent a day there with an interpreter who had worked there for 17 years, and with a couple of their staff members and many, many of their constituents, their students. And students go to the center who are in either they have a degenerative issue with their health where they're losing their vision and they are already deaf, or they've already lost their vision and are deaf, or they were born with those two disabilities. So at different stages. And at the center, these people learn how to navigate in the world without these senses available to them. So Ann and I spent the entire day. We had lunch. We spoke with staff. We talked to many people there, and we interacted with them, and we studied their movements, and we studied their approaches kinetically, and we really spent a lot of time thinking about how we wanted to tell the story. So it was a very rewarding day. We also had the dancers in the company when we began rehearsals. We had them learn the manual alphabet, which was the alphabet of the time, because we actually use the manual alphabet within the piece. It's a true dance theater piece. And we're excited with the fact that The Miracle Worker was done as a play very successfully by Gibson. And
right.
Also as a movie with Patty Duke and Anne Bancroft, and which was an amazing, amazing movie of its time. Again, this is another story like The White City that had never been told through dance. And dance is our medium of passion, and that is the story that we wanted to tell through what it is that we love to do and through the vocabulary that we know of dance.
And just for definition, of course, you're referring to The White City, which was your ballet taken from the book The Devil in the White City by Eric Larson. Interesting. What is the possibility? As we're talking here, I'm thinking, is there a possibility that you could have a student or somebody who is deaf or blind to come and be a ballet dancer?
Oh, Helen Keller had a chance to dance, not professionally, of course, but in a context with the Martha Graham Company. There's mm-hmm. information on YouTube about that.
Really?
And I have an amazing story about one of the staff members at the center who has something called Usher's disease, and we spoke with her. And she was a student at the Helen Keller National Center, and then she became a staff member there. And she has no hearing and no sight. And she was so excited to share with us her experience of going to see The Lion King. And she came, and she did what's called a touch tour, where she was invited on stage to touch and to feel everything. She came with two interpreters, one sat to her right and told her what was happening on stage visually. The other two were left with telling her what was happening storyline. And we asked her, how was that experience? Could you feel the music? Could you sense things? And she said it was one of the most exhilarating experiences of her life. And that was such a wonderful thing to hear, because she was able to have an experience that that was in its own way exactly what anyone who has sight and has sound would have too. And that was thrilling to hear about. And what we are doing for our production is we are offering at the Harris Theater March 3rd, 2 o'clock matinee, a touch tour which is happening prior to the performance. And people can call our offices here. Anyone who is sight impaired or blind can come. And we're going to be taking people on the stage to feel the sets, just like this person did at the Helen Keller National Center. We're also going to have an audio narrator for the piece, so those who are visually impaired can experience the work with a narrator and with headphones, so we're having audio available. So it's a pretty exciting component that Ann and I and Gail Ford, our executive director, talked a lot about in wanting to make sure that we extend these opportunities to the very community that we're celebrating and bringing awareness to. So it's pretty exciting.
It's terrifically exciting. Of course, the Chicago Lighthouse is for people who are blind or visually impaired. And, you know, you use the example of the Lion King. As much theaters I've been to, the entrance of the animals in the beginning of the Lion King as they come into the auditorium, it gave me goosebumps to watch them come in. And I can't imagine how it is with somebody who's sitting there and experiences for the first time and how they feel like something like this. And that's kind of interesting that would be the first introduction to the theater for them.
Oh, absolutely. But and it's amazing because they can feel the music, too, because the music in that particular show is extremely powerful. And, again, I mean, the narrators and the interpreters are really very, very clear in their communication to what is happening on stage and to size and to color and to proximity and all of that.
So. Well, besides A Light in the Dark, of course, K.T. Nelson has a performance that's going to be part of the concert series.
Oh, she does indeed. She came in and joined us at the very beginning of our season in the fall, and we had a wonderful two-week period with her, and she brought this refreshing, wonderful, it's like an ocean breeze. If I can just give you a visual.
We need an ocean breeze around.
We need an ocean breeze as opposed to a blizzard. No, she brought this wonderful West Coast energy about with her, and she said a beautiful work that really captures what she's wanting to say. It's a piece that has beauty and wit, and it really does address the idea that, you know, sometimes rest is not always possible. And it does that in a very whimsical way, and it's a delightful work that that I'm really excited for our audience to receive. And also, as a director, and I'm always looking at what's in our community here in Chicago, I really do notice that I don't see a lot of work coming from West Coast choreographers, and I really wanted to bring our Chicago audiences that flavor and that taste of the art that's being created and done on our West Coast, because it has its own wonderful and unique voice that is valid and important.
And, of course, Melissa Thotos, the very talented Melissa Thotos, will be presenting Subtle Passages.
Yes, that's my premier work this year. And it's a piece that is very abstract and very movement-based. It has a lot of what I consider to be a circular, cyclical images within it. And it really is a piece that, on a very abstract level, addresses the idea that one day we wake up and we see where we are, and we often just kind of wonder how we got there. There's been so many subtle transitions and changes that have brought us to where we are today that sometimes we don't always notice when they're happening, but in hindsight, we kind of see the path we had, even if we weren't as cogent of those changes along the way.
And I think that's reflective of Melissa Thotos and her great dance company.
Oh, thank you. Thank you so much.
You know, I know that you have done such great work with both White City and with A Light in the Dark. I think the next one might be considered, you talk about impossible ballets, would be a ballet about how the Cubs won the World Series. And that might be...
We might have to
see what Gary thinks of that one.
Chicago sports, that's a very powerful entity here.
It may even be a possible one, too. I don't know. Breathtakingly athletic, fiercely complex, powerfully beautiful, performing, vibrant choreography are but a few of the critical accolades that Thotos Dance Chicago has received since its inception. This ensemble of well-rounded artists who teach, choreograph, and perform brings contemporary dance to its audience with an appealing, unique style that incorporates a variety of dance forms created and performed with innovative flair. Award-winning choreographers Anne Reinking and Melissa Thotos are teaming again to co-choreograph A Light in the Dark, the story of Helen Keller and Anne Sullivan, their second full-length story ballet, this time based on the story of Helen Keller, the extraordinary woman who was deaf and blind, yet went on to become a world-famous writer, a political activist, and an inspiration to all who knew her incredible story. Thotostan Chicago's Winter Concert 2013 will be presented Saturday, March 2nd at 8 and Sunday, March 3rd at 2 at the Harris Theater for Music and Dance, 205 East Randolph in downtown Chicago. For information, 312-334-7777. On the line with us right now is Melissa Thotos. Melissa, maybe some people want some information about Thotostan Chicago. How would they get about through that?
Oh, they can come to our website, thotosdancechicago.org. They can order tickets online from the Harris Theater, which is our wonderful home theater for our seasons here in Chicago, and that's harristheaterchicago.org. They can order tickets online, 312-334-7777. And if there are any visually disabled or impaired folks that would like to come and experience our Sunday matinee, they can call and make arrangements with Gail here in the office at 312-266-6255.
Well, that's a great opportunity for them. And it's always a pleasure, dear, to chat with you on the show. And I know Jay Kelly will keep us abreast of what's going on with Thotostan Chicago. And the next thing that comes up, we're going to definitely be back chatting about it.
Oh, wonderful. Thanks so much for inviting me on the show. I really appreciate it. And it's always a really fun time.
My pleasure, Melissa. Thank you, dear.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Melissa Thotos, of course, from Thotos Dance Chicago. A Light in the Dark, a story ballet about Helen Keller and Ann Sullivan at the Harris Theater for Music and Dance, Saturday, March 2nd at 8 o'clock and Sunday, March 3rd at 2 o'clock. For information, 312-334-7777. Chicago Opera Theater presents the Chicago premiere of The Fall of the House of Usher by Philip Glass. Andreas Matisic takes his audiences to the edge of madness in his first season as Chicago Opera Theater's general director. Philip Glass's The Fall of the House of Usher, a gothic horror story which blurs the line between the real world and the supernatural, opens Chicago Opera Theater's 2013 season titled Power of Love, Love of Power. This is Andreas Matisic's inaugural season as general director of Chicago Opera Theater since assuming the position in June of 2012. Glass's haunting 1987 score for Edgar Allan Poe's macabre masterpiece with lyrics by Arthur Yorinks provides the perfect backdrop for this nightmarish journey to the edge of darkness. The Fall of the House of Usher, taking place at the Harris Theater for Music and Dance, 205 East Randolph, runs Friday, March 1st at 7:30. Our 2013 season emphasizes the tension between the power of love and the love of power, explains Matisic, who conducts both the Chicago Opera Theater and the Long Beach Opera performances. The Fall of the House of Usher is about internal and external collapsing worlds. Glass's music suspends reality and time, hypnotizing us on this journey to the edge of sanity. It's a 90-minute psychological roller coaster ride. And on the line with us right now is the man named by the Opera News as one of the 25 people who will make a difference in opera in this decade, conductor of the Long Beach Opera, director, designer, a man who not only sets the standard but defines the essence of excellence in the world of opera, and the general director of Chicago Opera Theater, now presenting Philip Glass's The Fall of the House of Usher, March 1st at Harris Theater for Music and Dance, 205 East Randolph, Mr. Andreas Matisic. Andreas, welcome to the Kevin Moore Show.
Well, hello. It's a pleasure.
Well, it's my pleasure, and congratulations on starting out with a bang with Edgar Allan Poe's very interesting short story.
I think that's what we're here for, you know, filling in the niche of the unexpected, and I think COT has a good track record, and I'm willing to push that even a little further as we go on.
Well, you know, we don't have the chance to listen to Philip Glass's work, and I think you bringing and starting out your season with this is just a brilliant way to kick off the 2013 season for Chicago Opera Theater.
Yeah, it's interesting, you know, that the last opera that was on an opera stage by Philip Glass in Chicago was Chicago Opera Theater Zakhnaten in 1999, I believe. And then it was 25 years ago at the Lyric Satyagraha. So I think it's time that the opera stages become a little bit more aware of one of the most important American composers of our time.
Well, now we have two enigmatic icons, Edgar Allan Poe, of course, the great writer of Gothic thrillers, and Philip Glass, who, although they are centuries apart, celebrate the past and present as you bring them to the stage with The Fall of the House of Usher.
Yeah, that's a good point. I think it fits so well. They fit so well together because the obsessiveness of some sort that the character of Usher brings in that story to us is so well reflected with the music that Philip Glass writes. You know, it's a repetitive music that is almost like the reoccurring thoughts that haunt Usher, and it really helps you suspend time and place to dive into this really enigmatic world of this guy where we don't really know in the original story what his issues are. You know, they could be anything, and I think that's the great thing about a great work of art. There's many different ways to see it, how it is.
If you were to pick any kind of composer to kind of put a story of Edgar Allan Poe's to music, Philip Glass would be the natural person you choose, though, right?
I would agree, so, yes. I have to say he's a perfect fit.
You know, this is a story of, as I said before, it's an American Gothic horror story of madness and foreboding. Maybe an incestuous relationship with his twin sister, of course, Madeline. Repressed homosexuality, which is a way that Ken Kazin comes and puts this together in a little different light.
Well, I think that, as I said before, you know, you can see the many different ways the incestuous innuendos that are in that story have been explored to some regard. Our director, Ken Kazin, you know, was struck about the close relationship between William and Roderick, and he saw it as a love story between the two, as an unfulfilled love story. Roderick, who is under the pressure of his family to be someone he doesn't want to be, and he thinks in the opera, you know, this house is built of tombstones, mm-hmm. and I would add to that tombstones of expectations to be someone. So it was very interesting when Ken Kazin came up with this idea to explore that side of the story that hasn't been explored.
And, of course, you introduce Madeline into the mix, who is basically everything that the family and the house has oppressed and suppressed for years.
It is that, and she's also in some way, you know, she's the twin sister of Roderick, and she almost embodies also the female side of him. It's the struggle between the two. It's the it's the coming together. It's the jealousy that she has, and maybe she kills Roderick because he's jealous of William. We don't really know. I think there's many ways and many questions we can come away from this evening, and that's been a real pleasure to talk to audiences afterwards who were kind of still thinking how it was and what was and who was.
Now, that's interesting, Andres, because you've had some talkbacks with the audiences, and has their feeling been, you know, what really happened, what really happens, and what's going to happen? I think that's what you're eliciting and stimulating their imagination and engaging that intellect with people to have a response like that.
And that's the point, I think. That's what art should be doing, right? We are, I think, you know, some of our roles are to ask the questions where all the answers already have been given.
Right.
Everyone knows the story of Usher, you know, the surface of the story, the goth and what happens right in there, and it has all the ingredients of that. But as I said, there's many questions still that can be asked of that story.
The theme of this season is the power of love and the love of power and the tension between the two. What made you kind of choose that for your opening season?
Well, because all the operas that we present this season, Usher, the Maria de Buenos Aires, and Joan of Arc, have that tension. You know, there's people who really have the love of power to do something to people. And then it's also on the other hand side, you know, to see what the power of love can do for people to survive, for people to prevail, for people to overcome some of these challenges. And I think each of these operas has that.
And I think starting out, of course, in your first year, you have this foundation to build on. Of course, a foundation that Brian Dickey and Alan Stone have set forth so well. But you're building on this foundation to make even a longer and a greater opera season than we've had in the past, which I think is something for all of us to look forward to.
Yeah, I think it's important for us to be more present throughout the year and not just have a festival, which is great, but I think it limits our recognition and also the enjoyment for our audiences to have more throughout the year. So that's why we are, you know, place our operas now at three different times of the year, and hopefully soon we'll expand that offering.
Well, it's something to look forward to. Founded in 1974 by Alan Stone, Chicago Opera Theater has carved a significant place for itself in the operatic life of Chicago and has reached an audience of hundreds of thousands through its main stage performances, community engagement, education programs in Chicago public schools, as well as its renowned Young Artist Program. Chicago Opera Theater presents first-class productions of operatic repertoire, ranging from the great works of the 17th, 18th, and 20th centuries to intimate contemporary productions by top-tier, internationally renowned conductors, directors, and designers. Philip Glass's The Fall of the House of Usher, a gothic horror story which blurs the line between the real world and the supernatural, opens Chicago Opera Theater's 2013 season, titled Power of Love, Love of Power. This is Andreas Matysik's inaugural season as general director of Chicago Opera Theater since assuming the position in June of 2012. And on the line with us right now is Andreas Matysik. Andreas, I'm going to give a phone number if people would like to get some tickets. That's 312-704-8414. I know you're recuperating. I appreciate you taking a little time just for our audience to know. I think you took a slip on the ice here, but you're persevering here. Hope you're feeling better.
I'm getting better, and, you know, I learned how to watch out for ice now in Chicago.
Well, when you hang out in Long Beach, you don't have much ice down there.
That's very true.
That's the problem. Well, I look forward to having you on the show again, of course, keeping tuned in to what's going on with Chicago Opera Theater. I know you have a voice here at the Kevin Moore Show, and we'll look forward to chatting with you again.
And see you all tomorrow at the opera.
Beautiful.
Bye-bye.
Thank you. Thank you, Andreas. Andreas Matysik, the general director of the Chicago Opera Theater, presenting The Fall of the House of Usher through March 1st at Harris Theater for Music and Dance, 205 East Randolph. Again, for tickets, 312-704-8414. It's going to be interesting chatting with Andreas as the year goes on with his other presentations, because we continue the great legacy of opera in Chicago. Well, that about does it for our show today. I thank you for sharing this last hour with me and hope you, our listeners, have enjoyed this time as much as I have. I'd especially like to thank our guest, Peter Guarino, the artistic director and a founding member of the Shakespeare Project of Chicago, now presenting My Name is Will, the music in the work of William Shakespeare, Thursday, March 7th at 7 at the Park Ridge Public Library, 20 South Prospect Avenue in Park Ridge. Our good friend, Melissa Thodos, who's presenting her winter engagement, A Light in the Dark, a story of ballet about Helen Keller and Anne Sullivan at the Harris Theater for Music and Dance, Saturday, March 2nd and Sunday, March 3rd. For information, 312-334-7777. And finally, Andreas Matysik, the general director of Chicago Opera Theater, now presenting Philip Glass's The Fall of the House of Usher through March 1st at Harris Theater for Music and Dance, 205 East Randolph. For information, 312-704-8414. It's going to be an exciting season for the Chicago Opera Theater, and we're going to look forward to chatting with Andreas as the season goes on. Finally, a famous writer once said, one ought every day at least to hear a little song, read a good poem, see a fine picture, and if it were possible, to speak a few reasonable words. I hope on our show today we have, at the very least, done just that, spoken a few reasonable words. At that, I'd like to wish everyone a good week, and as that British group once said, and in the end, the love that you take is equal to the love that you make. Have a great day.
It's now or never. The more I love, the more that I'm afraid. In your eyes I may not see forever. Forever. If we can be the best of lovers, yet be the best of friends.
if we can try with every day to make it better as it grows. Any luck, then I suppose the music, the music.